Hi, welcome to Holden Village. This is June 1996. Our speaker today is Tom Perry, who will be speaking to us on language rights, the issues. Let's listen in.
It's sort of generally been called about language rights, and there are a number of different ways we could go depending on interest and issues that come up. And I thought I would start by describing briefly the linguistic situation in Canada, at least the principal one, and just use that as a kind of example, because there are some differences with the United States that are considerable, and so there may be some things that come up in thinking about that get you started. Canada has two official languages. It's officially bilingual, French and English. Of course, if you go to British Columbia, you won't hear much French. If you go to Quebec, at least rural Quebec, you won't hear a whole lot of English. However, in principle, if you're caught speeding in Alberta, you can ask for the ticket in French. Occasionally, those principles don't get put into operation, but in any sort of official capacity, whether it's a court or whatever, you should be able to get legal services and so forth in the language of your choice. And all federal forms have a front side and a back side, an English side and a French side, depending on your point of view. So which is front and back? Throughout Canada, the education system, there is a choice for parents to have their children go to either French school or English school. And there are no mixed schools. There are schools that are either almost all English with French as a second language, or almost all French with English as a second language. And that's true across the country. Now, there are some differences, however. In Quebec, you have to be a proven Anglophone ancestry to get into an English school. Mm-hmm. Everyone else is required to go to French school. Mm-hmm. This means all immigrants. This is not the situation in the rest of Canada. In fact, in the rest of Canada, French immersion schools are considered to be somewhat prestige-related schools. So in some places, even elitist. That I go to French school, that sort of thing. So that the language landscape is fairly settled and the things are entrenched. However, we do have in the current political situation set of political developments that are not unrelated to language, and that's of course the wish of the current government of Quebec to separate from Canada and become a separate country, a French-speaking one, of course. Now, that's an old, long-standing issue, and there's really no comparison to anything in the U.S. at the moment. However, it's brought the language issue up once again in the form of, well, backlash in the West, muttering about having to spend all the money to print the French on the backside of forms and that sort of thing. The last time there was this discussion of secession in Quebec, there was a considerable balancing kind of Western secessionist discussion. In fact, there are a fair number of people in the provinces of Alberta and British Columbia that wouldn't mind being part of the northwestern U.S. or going off separately with Alaska or whatever, something different. So there's a big political issue surrounding all of this, part of which is a language issue. Perhaps one other thing to point out about the whole issue is that we have in Canada a bilingual country, which by policy is officially bilingual, but the present government of Quebec is without question radically monolingual. They wouldn't have English schools at all if they didn't have to. Whatever they can do to promote the exclusive use of French, they do. And one example is the Quebec sign law. It is illegal in Quebec to display any sort of sign with any other language in it than French. So this national department store chain, Eaton's apostrophe S, had to change all of their signs. They're now known as Eaton without apostrophe S in Quebec. So that you, if not in fact, at least you can see the intention of the current government of Quebec, and their intention is to create a French-only state. Now, I just wanted to bring that up as an example because it's perhaps something you can use to kind of compare to various situations in the United States. Does anybody know about the current language legislation? I know you do. Language legislation in the U.S.? What is the situation as far as official languages and any language laws that we have?
I'm not sure exactly what legislation is pending, but because of controversies in Florida and because of immigrant concerns in California, there's been movements talking about making English the official, somehow making some sort of law that affirms that English, American English, is the language of the United States.
Right. Actually, the United States has no official language.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. There is no law that states that English is the language that we must use or anything like that. And it's sort of a natural law, an accident of history, that the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were written in English. If they'd been written in something else, we might have been speaking something else these days. There is, as you said, though, legislation. I don't know where it is in Congress, but there is a bill that's been drafted even to make English the official language. That whole thing, as far as I know, got started in the 80s in something that people have been calling the English-only movement that started in California. It started around old S.I. Hayakawa. Remember him?
Yeah.
The senator who used to fall asleep?
Right.
The pictures of him with his tan on, you know, snoozing away on the Senate floor. That was something that he had a great deal to do, as far as I know. And as I understand the original group, they are fairly radical monolinguals like the Quebec nationalists, in that their intent was that it should not only be an official language, but it should be a required official language, meaning that you couldn't take your driver's license test and anything else, that they wouldn't have alternative forms in Spanish or something else to fill out. You would only get an English one. So, similarly, I think, to the situation for immigrants in Quebec, who basically either have to do French or somehow get claimed to be of English-speaking descent, you would have the same similar situation if, for example, a California government, which really subscribed to the original sort of views of the English-only movement, came to power. One linguist has pointed out, however, that the demographics of California are such that this could, in the course of 20 to 30 years, backfire.
Yeah.
As soon as there were enough electors who were Hispanic mother tongue to vote in a Spanish-only state. And this, I think, illustrates some of the problems with official languages. Because as soon as you declare one an official language, someone's going to want some other one to be an official language. And the demographics of the United States cannot be depended on to stay the same. British Columbia, for example, is primarily English-speaking province, and for years, the substantial minority in British Columbia was German. That was the largest second language group that existed in the province. A lot of German, and particularly Mennonite farmers in the lower mainland, the Fraser Valley area. That changed, however, when the old Chinatown of Vancouver sort of burst at the seams, and in the past 10 years in particular, an enormous influx of Chinese speakers, and so Chinese is the significant second language minority. There are plenty of others. These people, of course, choose to be English speakers because most of them, the recent ones, also came in with English. I think it's worth, you know, just as a thought experiment, trying to imagine what would happen to a state like California under, are there any Californians here? If there were a fairly strong official language law that said that English was the official language, what kind of impact would that have? Speculation? Any ideas?
I think it would have it would affect governmental agencies, but otherwise I think it might be like the legislation that's been really plowing its way through the United States for the last 15 years, requiring us to go to a metric measuring system. It would just be largely ignored and would fall of its own weight.
Parts of California, though, were Spanish settlements long, you know, long ago. So
that's a good point. The Hispanic community in California is not new. Its proportion has changed over the years.
In fact, that you know was the major issue because they were there long before somebody put up a fence and said, you know, everybody on this side is Mexican and everybody on this side is American. And a lot of those people have gone back and forth almost nomadically at times.
Yeah.
That I was going to say to your earlier question, it seemed to me to be chaos because, you know, L.A. is now the largest speaking, what, there's about six. It's the second largest, you know, outside of Mexico City and outside of Bangkok and outside of various other places, it's the largest group of people who speak that language that exists in the world.
Yeah.
In one location. How would you take them and say, you know, you now all have to speak English to do business.
Well, it would affect communication, newspapers, that kind of thing, but I don't know what exactly that would mean. And it would definitely affect social service agencies in terms of resources that people could have access to, and there would then be that requirement that they somehow learn a language other than what their mother tongue might be to access certain basic social services, even for recent immigrants in this country. That would be seen as being potentially.
Well, you're getting close to bringing up the cost factor. Well, no, just the operating cost factor of not having to have bilingual social workers or six kinds of brochures in the motor vehicle office, which is something that is often cited in language issues, that it costs less to pick one language and stick with it. And this is particularly what you hear in connection with education. well, put English in the schools, sink or swim.
But the cost, I mean, while that might be an advantage, if you're calling cost monetary, that might be true, but there are other costs that it would definitely be a detriment not to be able to accommodate other languages. I mean, the cost to the people whose culture is being denied, whose language is being denied, that would be a different kind of cost.
And the children being denied education.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great cost.
Yes, of course, when politicians use the word cost, they are talking about their budgets or ones they would formulate.
Strictly.
And not the ones that people would be formulating in 10 or 20 years.
They also would not be saying that children are denied an education, for example. They would simply mm-hmm. say they have an education if they get it in English.
Yeah. There have been, particularly recently, studies in other parts of the world comparing the performance of children who enter school and begin school for at least the first 3 years in their native language. In Papua New Guinea, they have a very extensive local language program where first literacy is done in the local language. Then they learn English, which is, of course, it's Tok Pisin, which is a pidgin English, a Creole, actually, the national language. Later, and they learn to read and write what they call European. What Australians speak in Papua New Guinea is European, which is what we call English. So they learn the national language, which is a Creole, and then they learn Australian or European or English, whatever you want to call it, in school. They find that the achievement of children whose first experience in literacy is in their local language, the one they learned at home, is higher in the long run. So that it's fairly clear now that if you start in someone's native language, the education is better overall. The educational level is better overall. And so the educational level for that group of people, whether they're Hispanics in California or wherever, will be greater overall as time goes on. Their level of literacy they reach is greater. So in those terms, long-term cost, you could be penny wise and pound foolish if you cut budgets so you won't have to teach in Spanish in the schools. What about this argument, though, that about whether or not to teach Spanish in Hispanic areas for schools, whether to actually spend the money doing that, or whether to, as actually happened in previous times in immigration, where assimilation and assimilation as quickly as possible is expected. How does that strike you? Is that are there any issues there that arise? I happen to know Scott has a few things to say. Yes, go on.
Well, the thing is, we're in kindergarten next fall in the local public school. And yeah, you know, there will be several non-English speaking children there. And I guess as a parent, you know, a lot of parents in our neighborhood opt to send their kids to private school because you don't have that problem.
Right.
You know, worrying that, you know, these other kids are going to keep the level of achievement down because, you know, I'll have to wait for them to catch up, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or the teacher's going to have to spend more time with them. And,
Well, minority populations who speak another language can be dealt with in several different ways. One is special English as a second language training.
Yeah, I don't know how they do it. I think they just have them in the class, though.
Yeah. Which, of course, raises a cost question again.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is bilingual education, where at least those who speak Spanish, say, are put in an atmosphere where they speak Spanish part of the time but begin learning English the rest of the time. There's also a balanced bilingual education where everybody, English mother tongue or Spanish mother tongue, all do both.
Which language are you going to pick?
Well, it is very carefully balanced for the, particularly through grade school. The models that I have seen in various places stick through it through grade school, where you get a very carefully planned sequence. So you have, say, your social studies in Spanish one time, and maybe the next year you'll have it in English, so that you get this pretty well mixed up. And then by the time you get to high school, it is still a 50-50 chance, but you don't know if you're going to get biology in Spanish or in English or whatever. That's the balanced bilingual education model.
Where is that done?
Well, there's a very good example of it in Berlin called the John F. Kennedy School, which is carefully kept to 50% English mother tongue, 50% German mother tongue, and they both do both languages. And
is there an example of that in this country?
Not that I know of. Not a balanced. Canada does not do bilingual education at all. You have to choose either a French school or an English school. So English is a second language. Within an English school, specialized bilingual education for Hispanic students or balanced bilingual education are different responses to minority populations. All of them cost something.
They must be. Don't states legislate things like this too?
They do. The states are in control of education. However, it could come to something like the situation in Canada, where the federal government makes certain framework requirements. They won't tell you how to do it, but they'll tell you that you have to offer everyone the opportunity to attend a school in the language of their choice. And so each district will have a number of French schools of different levels, and you can elect to send your child to that school.
How does that work in a rural setting where the student population isn't very high?
I'm not entirely sure, but it may mean travel or even boarding in British Columbia, which is very far flung. And there are significant populations in BC who... BC does not have Holden High School type places. They have correspondence. They use correspondence and telephone so that you call up your teacher and you get packages in the mail. So I presume they can have those in French as well as English.
Education is changing so much in all states, and I was visited in California quite a bit near Anaheim in that area, and the little girl she's in first, second, and third grade. All three grades, she's been learning Spanish along with English.
Mm-hmm.
And like in Washington, D.C., most people send their children to private schools. And like in Oregon right now, they're beginning to allow private schools where they didn't used to. So people will have more control over what their children learn too.
Since we have raised the business of cost and everything, and private schools have come up a couple of times, are there any states which now subsidize private school tuition?
Oregon has just started allowing the private schools.
Arizona has a huge movement to start charter schools.
Mm-hmm. Canada has subsidized private schools. And also has charter schools.
Now, what is the charter school?
That is, as I understand the way it works in Canada, there are only a few, it's recent. It is more or less a neighborhood-controlled school that subscribes to certain basic educational principles. And in truth, they are often sort of no-frills schools.
Watch it. What you define as frills?
Of course, music's done.
Yes, of course, music. But you know, they may not have sports, for example. You know, competitive sports and things like that. I'm trying to remember what I know of a couple of charter schools that have come up in Vancouver. I know the one. I'm not sure they have a high school yet, but the one has. They have uniforms. They have very careful attention to sticking to, you know, the basics like reading, writing, and arithmetic, and that sort of thing. So that they are in a sense kind of basic schools. Yeah.
There's an initiative in the state of Washington right now for charter schools, but it's a very flawed one, and the people sponsoring the school are responsible directly to the State Board of Education and are not responsible to their local Board of Education. And that may kill it, but there still is a really strong interest. And in effect, the state of Washington and lots of other states have what are charter schools, in that people, parents have established within the public school system have really lobbied for certain schools that might emphasize music or might emphasize a classical education or something like that. And they exist because of the strong parental involvement. And usually every year those parents struggle to keep it in the school budget. And those really are basically charter schools that the local districts allow.
Jean, I wanted to ask you, what is the, your understanding of the, what is the motivation for a single language? Where does that come from? I mean, many people in the world, I lived in Switzerland for a while when I was studying. They seemingly had no problem living in a state where people spoke five different languages. And I mean, that was an accepted reality, and they even worked it out legislatively, you know. I mean, people either understood all of the languages or they had translations going all the time. It was just an accepted way of life. That if you live in Switzerland, you know, you deal with German and you deal with French and you deal with Italian, and if you live in the center of the country, Romansh. And that's the way it is, you know.
The United States is peculiar. It's peculiar in the sense that for centuries, up until fairly recently, the last 200 or 300 years, it was impossible to imagine not being multilingual. Unless you were a peasant who worked on the same farm and never went anywhere, it was almost impossible to do anything without encountering people who spoke other languages, whether it was in Europe or in Asia or wherever. Places like India and China are enormous landscapes of different languages. We think perhaps of China as this monolithic monster with a billion speakers of one language, but there are enormous numbers of different languages in China, and different Chinese languages besides Mandarin, that is entirely different languages that belong to the Chinese family. And most people in China are quite multilingual. Well, with the British Empire, and to some extent I think with British attitudes about language, it became possible to think of a place like the U.S., which for a long time has been remarkably monolingual. I mean, there have been Spanish around the edges, there's been a little French here and there, and there are, of course, all the native languages. But things have moved forward without any opposition to English being in practice, the only language. So we have this very peculiar heritage of not ever having thought about being multilingual. The idea of walking up to our bank and seeing four signs on it in different languages would just be mind-boggling to us. And to tell you the truth, it is taking some people aback in Vancouver to walk up to their bank and discover that they have put up a new sign that's in Chinese characters and in English. And certainly in my end, the eastern suburbs, that's new in the last 3 or 4 years. And most banks have it because I think there's a lot of money in them. Because the Hong Kong people who are moving to the eastern suburbs are not particularly poor folks. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, this is a new thing for people in Canada and in Western Canada, and it's just thinking about this is a new thing in the U.S., I think.
Well, just the last 2-3 years, maybe at the most, our little town in Mount Vernon has become have more Spanish available. I mean, you can, when you go to your bank machine now, it does ask you whether you want it, the questions and stuff in Spanish or in English. If you go to the health department, everything is available in both Spanish and English. If you go to into the court system, you have a translator if you're a Spanish speaker, and they make sure someone is there, they have access to translators. But this has all happened there just in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And they're starting now to have their emergency response people have some Spanish training. Because 3 years ago, I was at an accident, and there were a lot of, it was a car full of people that were primary Spanish speakers, and not one of the responders from the fire department or the police department spoke any Spanish at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had to rely on me, and that was minimal. But now I know that they are trying to make sure on each shift there are Spanish speakers. So this is a real change for, you know, a rural area, mm-hmm. relatively rural area in Washington.
How do you meet that question, and that should we spend government money to make sure that there are Spanish-speaking responders on first response teams or teachers in the schools or whatever? Yeah.
Well, those people are taxpayers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's reasonable.
In the light of that fact and those facts, what does this English-only legislation have to do with anything? I mean, why is it there? I mean,
prejudice.
Never mind the election year rhetoric, and I understand Bob Dole has endorsed it, and, you know, and all this stuff. What does it have to do with let's take the surrounding area here, the orchard areas, where there are so many Spanish speakers. Why should someone then be supporting an English-only law? I mean, why do you imagine?
Power. People who have access to the language have access to power.
Well, what if I, you know, lived in Chelan my whole life and I get in a car accident and the responders come and they only speak Spanish? And I'm sitting there and I'm allergic to penicillin, I can't tell them. It's a fear that, you know, in what I consider my native area, in my native tongue, I can't get help, or someone's going to get something that I deserve.
May you pretend that they can't speak English if they're in the right place at the right time. We have a lot of bitterness in our country because the pay scale is low enough already, you know. But it's the Spanish people come in and they will work for less than minimum wage, even if the employer could get away with it, doing it. And so they're coming into our country quite rapidly right now. And the people who pay the taxes are the ones who don't want to have to pay to encourage people like that to come in. And
So you see it as connected to an immigration issue, mm-hmm. ultimately. Mm-hmm.
I think it can be a really bad thing.
Well, in our experience in Canada, that's true, because Quebec is the only province in Canada that has its own immigration laws. You have to get into Canada and into Quebec if you want to live in Quebec. When the last referendum over separation lost, the premier of the province, who was, of course, in the separatist party, blamed the immigrants, said you didn't vote with the people of Quebec. He lost his job over that, but it kind of revealed what was going on there in terms of that party's view of what Quebec ought to be like, and it doesn't have much room for immigrants. It has created enormous divisions within Quebec, and the situation with respect to the political future of the province is quite up in the air. For one thing, the native population are quite adamantly opposed to the current provincial government. They see them as wanting eventually in some French state to eradicate the native culture even more thoroughly, and they voted in large numbers in their own referenda that they put on to stay in Canada if Quebec wants to leave. And many of the immigrant populations in Montreal think that Montreal could secede from Quebec and become part of Canada again if that happens. So all kinds of scenarios open up. Just sort of project this onto California and imagine Los Angeles and San Diego trying to join Mexico while... I mean, that's the sort of chaos that might, you know, that people are talking about possibly happening there. So immigration is a real serious issue behind a lot of these linguistic questions. Money is one, but immigration is another. Yeah.
Just to add to the immigration issue, I hear people talking about this, just common folks like in our congregation. And what they will say is, I went into the grocery store and there were these people talking in another language, and you would think if they were in our country, they would speak our language. I'm offended, and I speak of this with great, they take great offense. And it's in our country, they're coming, it's a we, they issue. And it seems, I think it's related to the economic issues in many cases.
Well, just to play devil's advocate and talk and respond to that, then we here, sitting here tonight, should probably be speaking the Entiat dialect of Middle Columbia Salish. If because you got there first means that the people who come later ought to speak your language, then by that logic we all ought to be speakers of Salish.
I also suspect that many of us have parents or grandparents who grew up in bilingual households, or maybe spoke exclusively Norwegian, or in my case German, until mm-hmm. the war forced them to stop speaking.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't the heart of that public-private distinction? That in your public life, the goal was to speak one language, or what you did in your own home with your grandparents.
Or with your church, because that was private.
Yeah, in a sense private language. But the argument is just about culture, it's about creating a common culture. The idea has been a common commerce, a common school system, a common cultural ethos. It was all a great American experiment that was called the Melting Pot. And that had its day, and there's a huge cultural conversation going on about whether to stay on that course or to acknowledge the fact that national borders are more permeable, that the world is in a sense getting smaller because of communication realities, and that some would argue we simply don't have the luxury of a wall around ourselves that would protect what they would call a kind of provincialism. And the others, I suppose, would argue that this is the most prosperous country in the world, and that one of the reasons for that is that we've formed a unique and common culture here based on one language, one set of symbols that gave it unique and creative power, and that there's much to be thankful for in that.
But I don't feel that the melting pot really ever worked. I mean, this country never dealt with issues and problems of race until the late 1950s and 1960s, with the Civil Rights Movement. I think that in terms of European Americans, yes, there were conflicts and there was the effort to try and develop this common culture, the common American culture, but there were still divisions between Protestants and Catholics in the 1920s. There was huge movements in Oregon amongst the Klan to try and expel Catholics from the state. I think it has to do with prejudice and racism. I think it's bound up with language then. But I mean, those are issues that are at the root of a lot of what we're talking about.
And I think you can make a fair argument that each one of those examples is also proof that the American experience works, because we did address the racial question in the 60s. We did address this. We're late in getting to some things, but as the experiment unfolds, it is working.
Wait, then why did the LA riots happen? My sense is, at least from my generational perspective, I question if it's working. I grew up in a very white community, and I learned nothing about, much less African-American people, learned anything about Hispanic or Jewish people, and didn't learn about those things until I went to college.
Well, the troublesome reality here is that in order to have a diverse universe, which I presume we all see the value of, what you were talking about the other day, and the loss of language is the loss of the ability to put into words, symbols, and pictures realities that aren't possible in other languages. And that probably we could agree that diversity is fundamentally good, but at the other end of the reality is the only way true diversity works is if you have a variety of absolutely non-diverse realities within it. You can't have diversity unless you have sort of white-hot cells of uniformity within it. And the question is, what is the rub in the conversation is between the border of our desire for a diverse world and the need for, if that is to happen, for there to be absolutely non-diverse elements within it. A seafood stew is only good if the shrimp tastes like shrimp. You don't want them to taste like parts of all the other seafood. You want them to taste like shrimp. And you want to taste the scallop. But we want to argue that the larger whole is a unique creation that's also wonderful. Right. But it seems to me it's those two realities of the need for, in a sense, some uniformity and orthodoxy in order to create this beautiful diversity. I think that's where we hit the rub.
Yeah, I think the word orthodoxy is a good one to use there. What happens so much is that much of this discussion is initiated not so much by the principle or even, let's say, average numbers, but by patterns. It's no accident that it comes up in Florida and California. It's because people have a local vision and they extrapolate to national things. If the Hispanic people in this country were distributed evenly across the whole country, it would not be nearly the discussion that it is, because there would be very few in each community.
Well, two things. When Boot said something that was interesting, you know, about, and I've heard that too, people feeling like, hey, we're the majority here, we speak English, when you come here, you ought to speak English, feeling. And again, that's a different attitude than you meet in other places in the world. We've had the good fortune to live in two different places outside of the U.S., in Switzerland and in Norway. And in both places, I made some attempt to learn the local language, and I would try to use it. And people recognizing my feeble attempts would speak back to me in English, because their English was better than my Norwegian, or their English was better than my Swedish.
But they listened to your attempts, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And I began to understand that they saw that as the hospitable thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the value that somehow had gotten lodged in their head someplace along the quite a different sort of attitude. So even though they were very much in the majority, I was very much in the minority, for some reason or another along the way, they had this was their Now, I saw some, and maybe you know these statistics, I saw some statistics a while ago that talked about, you know, what is the U.S. going to look like in 2030, and it's rather, would be rather frightening to this group.
Yes.
Because I think...
Well, I think it is. I think that they've probably seen some of the statistics, and it's probably part of it.
I don't remember them off the top of my head, but I think that clearly people of European descent will be in the minority.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yes.
And so, you know, if we instituted this sort of one language law, exactly what, I mean, it's the same thing. I've been to Israel quite a few times, and one of the obvious reasons why the Israelis didn't let the Palestinians vote early on was because there were more Palestinians. And they simply would have voted the Israelis out of office. I mean, in Israel, you would no longer have been a Jewish state because there were more Palestinians in the country than there were Jewish Israelis. I mean, there are more Palestinian Israelis than there were Jews.
So having a Palestinian state is actually a better solution than letting them be full partners in Israel.
Well, sure. Yeah. Obviously. And it was one of the reasons why they weren't allowed to vote, and they had two school systems, and they essentially created a political apartheid system.
Maybe that's why Spanish-speaking people want to establish this one language thing to encourage people to learn English as they come into the country.
Well, the truth is that, you know, first of all, many times we think either Spanish-speaking or English-speaking, and we forget that bilingualism is an option, and that Spanish-speaking people who settle here in the, you know, around Leavenworth and down through Chelan and Wenatchee, they're going to be motivated to learn English because they have to go to Walmart and they have to go to places where they need to speak English. It's at home, basically, that they speak Spanish. I don't know if they can get a Spanish radio station, but...
Well, in other states, too, like German settlement or another language.
And their children, if they go to school, will get English in school, even if it's mixed with Spanish in some way. So that the next generation, and we also think only in terms of our own generation, the next generation might likely be quite different.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Well,
generation. Well, if you look, take for example, do you know what the largest language population in the Middle Columbia Valley was in the 1860s? What do you think the biggest language was?
German.
Russian.
Mm-hmm. It was probably a native language, right?
No.
In 1860?
Not even close. Mm-hmm. It was Chinese. There are over 1,000 Chinese miners in the Middle Columbia Valley during the 1860s. And they were nearly twice as much as all the natives up and down the river and white settlers. There was a three-cornered sort of problem in the Columbia Valley then. The Chinese, who did not get along with the native population, the white settlers, well, in general, it's miners who didn't get along with the native population. So there was a lot of back and forth in different directions over that. But that, you know, the next generation changed. And what caused the change then in 1882 was the Chinese Exclusion Act, which prevented any further immigration from China. When they built the railroads, they thought it would be great to have all these Chinese workers who they were good labor. But they didn't work very long on the railroad. They quit and they went off and tried their luck at mining. So they finally got fed up with this, and after a lot of complaints from miners in this part of the world, passed the law saying you can't bring in any more Chinese immigrants. A very similar situation could develop here, where we actually get calls for selective immigration acts that say cut off the flow of people from Mexico or whatever.
In fact, what's happened recently is that they have expanded the number of people that they're going to permit to come in on work from Mexico, because there's an organizing effort about to start among shed workers and migrants here, and so they're going to flood the market with more workers and kill that effort. Republicans are fighting legal immigration, but opening the floodgates to temporary work permits. It's a very interesting strategy.
Well, it's because the economic, I suppose, reasons, right?
They can keep the Hispanic folk from organizing.
And, you know, another interesting development is in Southern California now, Arizona, new languages are emerging. We have the Spanish English language that's emerging on the border, which is, you know, a bit of this and a bit of that. And so what's happening is we're increasing the numbers of languages that people are dealing with.
And in truth, that's really nothing new either in multilingual settings. And the language Chinook, for example, is really a mishmash of French, English, and some of the native languages from down towards the end, the mouth of the Columbia. And that was widely used up and down the coast and in the interior here as a trade language. And wherever languages meet, there's the opportunity for that sort of thing to happen. In fact, English itself is really a Creole. It is a product of Anglo-Saxon meeting Norman French. You know, the Normans ruled England for 200 or 300 years, and the product of that was Middle English. That's to be expected in where languages come together and they try to find some common ground. Sometimes the common ground is a saw off between them.
Well, I just think, you know, as a person living in a multicultural
society is just less comfortable, you know, and you want to reach out to people, but you can't because you have a barrier. And I think just that's what's frustrating to me. It makes the place I live much less friendly, much more. Gosh. Sorry, everybody.
She has her views on language.
And you know, I'm frustrated because I don't know what to do about it. I mean, yeah, I can go learn other languages, I guess. But it makes me sort of feel bad because I'm a person that likes to connect with people.
Yeah.
And I just find I go to the store, I don't bother saying hi or, you know, I mean, or even trying to start up a conversation when you're waiting in line next to somebody because you don't know if they're going to speak English or not. And I guess it just makes my neighborhood feel less friendly because of the communication barrier. And I've never ever felt so close in my life to people of African American heritage because we share the common language, you know? And I've never, you know, this is my first experience not living in a, you know, mostly upper middle class white suburb. And it was kind of a surprising thing to experience within me, that feeling of common bond with people of African American descent, just because we have shared many more years in the same culture, you know, if they've been in the United States. So, you know, I'm not a political person, but just from a feeling point of view, it's, you know, I want to reach out to my neighbors. If people, you know, they moved in across the street and they speak Portuguese, well, I guess I'm not going to get to know them too well. You know, that kind of thing. And it just makes, you know, I guess that's why you have that certain feeling in large cities, you know, anonymity, and you can't talk to each other. So maybe that might be some motivation for some people. It's kind of a idealistic one. But, and it's a hard thing to learn another language. You know I could go to night school and start to study Spanish. But, it's a hard thing.
I lived about 8 years in New Mexico, and there with 40% Hispanic and 40% Anglo and 20% Native American, it's quite a culture. And there's so much of everything there that you do learn at least the words of greeting and all the different languages, and working as a medical person there, having to learn Spanish because some of my patients were primary Spanish speakers, and being able to converse with them was real important. Because I was surrounded by the language, I mean, you learn it.
If you have the need, maybe that's your motivation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, even if you're surrounded by it there, which I think is going to get more and more in cities, you get surrounded by languages. So it was easy to learn it. It was, and then once you started learning the language, you began to be more invited into the culture. And so it was a good experience. You know, my Spanish now is not terribly good. I do everything in present tense, but maybe that's good. Maybe that was sort of my Buddhist training or something. You know, if it happens in the future or in the past, I don't know anything about how to talk about it. But I...
Your clock only has now on it.
Yeah, that's right. It's only now. And spending time in Honduras and being immersed in a different culture and having rudimentary skills in language, I think learning other languages is a hospitable thing to do. And I would like to be in a culture that's hospitable in that way.
When I was growing up and I was in high school, there were a lot of Japanese American girls. I went to a girls' school. And when Pearl Harbor was bombed, they had their autonomous assembly. And I never will forget the president spoke and we heard him declare war. And then they played the Star Spangled Banner and everybody stood up, but a lot of the Japanese girls didn't stand up. And I just think that if we don't, in America, if we don't protect ourselves by having a basic language, we're going to be a lot of countries against each other, so to speak, aren't we? Isn't that? Because these girls felt loyal to their own country. What I'm saying is if you are broken up by the different languages, mm-hmm. and one language isn't required, maybe I'm all wrong here. You know, like if you're a descendant from Germany or Japan or wherever you are, if you're still speaking the language of the country that you came here from, and basically we were, you know, it was the English people that started America. It wasn't the Russians. I mean, the ones who really established us, weren't they all basically English speaking? No, well, it seemed like we should protect ourselves by staying one language anyway.
Didn't we come within four votes of speaking German or something like that?
I think we did, but still that was where we started. But it seems like something should be standard or we're going to be...
Well, because we have no official language, in fact, it's always been a freedom to simply speak whatever language we wanted. Now, if that was Hmong, or one of those obscure Southeast Asian languages, you could ask yourself, how useful is this?
Yeah.
It's like we have a family friend whose parents were Maltese, and her mother still can't go to the doctor alone. She doesn't know, I mean, she's been in Canada for 45 years. And I guess that's her freedom. If she doesn't want to bother with English, she can speak Maltese to whoever she can find. But if you want to be in business in this country, you have to at least speak English. And in some locales, you might have to know Spanish. If you were going to open a business in these valleys around here, it would be advisable for you to have an employee who spoke Spanish if you wanted to sell things to Spanish speakers. So it is a matter of choice in that sense. We've always had that sort of option. But it has varied a lot as to the feelings that go on at particular times. I know that my brother-in-law was born in 1942. My in-laws were of Swedish descent. My father-in-law came from Sweden. He didn't get any Swedish name because they didn't think that that was a good thing to do, that they didn't want to appear to be immigrants then. My wife was born after the war, and she was named Brit, because by then they thought it was quite all right to name the Swedish name. So attitudes change, and you do have this kind of cyclic thing, and certainly World War II was a time when it was not a good idea to seem foreign, particularly not German or Japanese. Or to some extent Italian. Yeah.
What's behind this really ferocious language argument going on in France? They are really tightening down the screws on the officialness of French and the, even the the Anglicizations of French words are being banned, and what's going on there?
Well, actually, that is nothing new. It's just that every few years there's another flurry of it in the news, but they keep hacking away at this for a long time. Now you get an idea of where some of this comes from in Quebec.
Yeah.
In fact, Charles de Gaulle made a trip to Quebec in which he openly incited separatism and love of the French language. His speech in Quebec City was a classic of stirring up somebody else's pot.
Yeah.
And it has been a kind of a national obsession in France since the Enlightenment, basically. France has an academy that is in charge of the French language. It's not necessarily illegal, but it is certainly unpatriotic and immoral to speak the French language badly.
Especially immoral.
I had an office across the hall from a professor of French. He was a Parisian on top of it. You should hear him and see what he has to say about Quebec French. But he was dressed like someone from Paris. He was a member of Les Amis du Vin and had his silver tasting cup and everything. And I was very lucky because he came out of his office one day when I had first gotten there and spoke to me in French, and I detected that this guy is a real Frenchman. And so I said, if you don't mind, I'll speak to you in English because I wouldn't want to mess up your beautiful language. And he thought I was the smartest guy there.
You didn't fight.
I didn't feed him yet, you know, more of this Quebecois drivel that he was used to hearing in Quebec.
Okay,
so it is something,
of those really particularly succulent shrimp that we should encourage to, I mean, should the rest of the world support France in its desire to preserve the purity of this language? And then if that's true, because for broader purposes of world culture, it's valuable to have this part, this thing going, then what do we say? I mean, might not they argue that we should be of one language too or something? I mean, what are the implications of that?
Well, the implication of it might be that, well, we ought to give up this English stuff and speak French like they do.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, in France, aren't they teaching English as the secondary language in their schools?
They are. English used to be not terrifically popular in France, but since England entered the European community, they discovered there's money in it. Then it becomes an economic issue. In both Germany and France, English has made enormous headway, if you want to look at it that way, as a second language since about 1970.
Yeah, for economy reasons.
Yeah,
well, for economic reasons. Throughout Europe, I mean, American films.
They dub them, those countries. And their speech communities are big enough that they could, I mean, they're very similar to Japan. Japan, English has not made a lot of headway. For all the money they have spent doing it, English still has not made a lot of headway in Japan. And that was true in Germany and France in particular through the 60s anyway. But that has changed recently. It may be changing in Japan too.
And I've heard of it. I mean, I don't know about France, but in Germany, seems like English speakers, I mean, second language is still everywhere.
Yeah, it is.
You know, something we were talking earlier about our uncomfortability, our discomfort with people who speak a different language because we can't communicate with them in the way in which we can communicate with somebody that speaks the same language that we do. But, you know, again, there are other models For example, I remember one summer our family traveled through Europe. We camped. And our little guy at that time was about 4 or 5 years old. He had his bag of burrito train parts and also a bag of Legos. And every place we camp, out would come the burrito train and the Legos. And soon there was a community of children, all speaking different languages, building burrito trains and building building Legos, and seemingly doing quite well in communicating, even though they didn't have the same words. And you can, I mean, that's just a kind of almost a metaphor that comes to mind. But you see adults doing that in different countries too, who don't speak very well. I mean, they don't speak each other's languages very well, but they develop other ways of being together. And that also, I think, is a foreign idea, a strange idea, because we haven't experienced it.
It's, like I said, this country is peculiar, and in most of the world, that sort of thing is the normal course of events. I recall having to take one of our children to an emergency room in Italy. I ended up having to converse to the doctor who spoke Italian. I spoke German to a Korean nurse who then addressed them. But this, I mean, they quickly recognized the solution and they got on their intercoms, and then pretty soon this Korean nurse appears, you know, because they had gotten out of me that it was either English or German, take your pick. And so that kind of reaction is fairly standard in most of the world. It is in English-speaking countries that have become really peculiar, in that sense, and not being used to that.
If this building were located in Germany, for example, right? We'd all have chairs in front of us, headsets. You'd be speaking in English, but there would be people in the room who couldn't speak English who would be using the headsets, and then when they spoke, you put your headset on, and I mean, this would be a conversation that would be, we would have accepted the reality that we speak different languages, and would not be a problem.
You know what we don't have in our universities here, which is a symptom of it? We don't have things that they have all over Europe and the rest of the world. That's interpreters' institutes. People who learn simultaneous interpretation, the ones who sit in the glass booths and speak into the headsets.
Right,
we just don't have people like that in large numbers at all.
Would it be that if we go to another country and speak English, I mean, we keep talking about the other countries, you know, are willing to speak English, it's hospitable. But it's also economic.
Yes.
It's a very good deal to be open to American tourists or to English tourists. It's almost the opposite here, when for a lot of people we speak to with a foreign language, whether it's Chinese or Spanish, it's almost a negative economic or a perceived negative economic drain on the community. When you go to Mount Vernon and you have Hispanics in an accident, there's a perception of that language is draining resources. But when I go to Italy and speak English, it's that language is bringing in money.
Well, if I were getting an MBA right now, I think I would want to know either Chinese or Japanese. You know, you can look at linguistic skills and put price tags on them in a certain sense. Mm-hmm. And as you say, you can look at them and say, well, that's a negative price tag. If you take the model of the United Nations, they expect that they're going to have all these different employees who speak all these different languages. So they have, I don't know, I think it's up to 6 now, official languages. And one of the requirements is you speak one of them to start with. Then you can, you have to continue working on more of them as you go on in years, so that you, you know, you go to lunchtime language classes or whatever, and it becomes an expectation. What our problem is, what Australia's problem is that our expectations is that things will remain the same. But it's not clear from the examples we have in California and Florida that that's a necessarily economically sound idea in the first place. It might be useful, and as it might be for our children, instead of thinking of having to have paramedics who speak Spanish, of having our own children speak Spanish, that might turn out to be an advantage for them. Even though it has nothing to do with the jobs they get at McDonald's for teenagers, when they're teenagers, or going to college or anything else, it might yet be 20 years before it turns out to have been a good idea. Demographics change. Plus, economic alliances change. I mean, we're looking at free trade with Mexico, we're looking at free trade down into South America, and it could be that good paying jobs in the commercial sector might require Spanish or Portuguese eventually. Yeah.
It seems like in France they try to preserve the language.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Look at, is there any place where English is spoken where people really work at preserving the English language? Is there a kernel of purity someplace?
English.
Well,
the Brits will say.
Jack Windsor Lewis, who is the pronunciation editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, said this about that. He said, there is only one person who speaks the Queen's English, and she can't help it. She had an odd upbringing.
Oh.
Oops.
Oh.
Sorry.
There's
not much I can do. Just catch
her.
Catch
her.
Yeah,
you can't cap those.
Can't
cap
them.
Yes.
It just comes out the side.
She doesn't
it's
crush it.
It's
fine.
It's
fine.
It's
fine.
It's okay. Cheers.
And look at our mates. Well, the answer is, I think, probably not.
But what did I didn't that? Could you say that again, please?
Well, there's only one person who speaks the Queen's English. She can't help it. She had an odd upbringing. English has been quite different than French.
It's just not.
In that it being completely the other way, and the English, where it has gone around the world, has adapted, and the French don't like to see French adapt. But I think they went to get help.
When we were living in Norway, the Brits that were living there would inform me quite regularly that it was not English that I spoke.
Yeah. They're quite sure of that.
And they were quite sure of it. They would make that distinction quite emphatically in that situation. When I would say I spoke English, they'd say no. So
yeah, and they
speak American or something.
Right. This fellow who was the pronunciation editor of the OED said that it's the Brits who still haven't figured this out. So, as far as language purity, there, the battle is lost for English.
Mm. are just too many different kind of shrimp.
That's right.
Going back to the schools for a moment, I was wondering, has there ever been an effort to take, well, there's a large immigrant population coming in, whether it's Hmong or Spanish or whatever, of taking the children who are going to be educated and perhaps for a period of time, maybe even as long as a year, just focusing on the language of English that they're going to need proficiency in to learn in the schools if English is only going to be used as the school language. Has that ever been done that you know of?
There have been experiments like that. And they go something like this. I know some in Canada, and I believe I have heard about some of these in Spanish-speaking parts of the U.S. And what they do is they take subject areas and they'll just study that one subject area in a target language. And in that way they will concentrate on one. So they'll like do social studies for several months. This is with older kids, not with beginners, like sixth, seventh grade, something like that. And they, you know, these are experimental things, so they do testing them to find out whether their comprehension was better doing it that way than just having the usual sort of, now we'll do an hour of social studies, now we'll do an hour of English, and that sort of thing. I don't know whether they've been very effective that way or not. With respect to bilingual education, there are so many different ideas coming out about it that we may see more of that sort of thing, where you'll have sort of an intensive Spanish school for a while, and then you'll flip and you'll do something else, like have English, an English blitz for several months, and very focused sorts of things. I don't know what it's going to turn out to be, and I'm not an educator, so I'm not up on exactly what they're doing. I just hear these things through discussions of teaching language.
I was especially curious because the school where I taught started a French immersion program, and there were four classes.
Yeah.
These children came in as first graders, and they were spoken to only in French by their teachers. In regard to they refused to speak English to them because they really wanted to immerse them. And the only time they had English spoken was when they went to the special of music and art and PE. And I could really see how rapidly those children learned as first graders learn French.
That is the method that's used in Canada for French and British Columbia, for all the non-French-speaking parts of Canada. About 7 or 8 years ago, the first products of that system arrived at the university. And although they could gab a blue streak in French, it turns out that they are considerably behind as far as writing and composition. And this wasn't for lack of trying, either. Mm-hmm. Our French department devised these, what they kept calling remedial courses of French for French immersion products, but the university kept telling them, you can't call them that.
Bonehead French.
It wasn't bonehead, it was specifically directed at bringing them up to speed in writing. So that very often every system has its kind of weak spots. That seems to be one of them. I mean, the immersion sort of thing does promote fluency, but it doesn't necessarily promote the full scale of fluency in everything, including writing. So The problem is that learning a language as a second language, you learn it in spite of your teacher, in spite of the method, in spite of the textbooks they give you. There is no surefire way to do it. And immersion works, sure. But it's not perfect either. Going to a country where they speak the language and getting hungry is the first way to really start learning the language.
Or having to go to the bathroom.
Yeah. There are plenty of countries that are happily bilingual. Switzerland is one example. There are plenty of countries that have made that change recently. I think most of the Scandinavian countries are thoroughly bilingual in English as well as their native Scandinavian language.
Well, plus they often speak two or three different...
like, other languages.
Well, in Norway, for example, young people would speak their local dialect of Norwegian, and they would learn Nynorsk in the schools for the sake of the government, and they would speak English because they would go to English films and watch English television and listen to English musicians and had acquaintances that were English speakers and so forth. So,
my wife has a relative in Sweden who's about my age who decided when he was in his 20s to speak English with a Texas drawl.
They do that in Stavanger, Norway.
He loves cowboy movies.
They do it in Stavanger because of the oil industry. And all these Texans that came up there. They even, the Norwegians tell Texan jokes.
They do that in New Mexico and Arizona and those places.
Yeah, they know they tell Scandinavian jokes. Holy and lame jokes. But these Norwegians have their own set of jokes about Texans. It's a curious.
I think one of the things that we learned from those situations is that the more you do it, the easier it gets.
Right.
That if you look at the countries that deal with lots of different languages, nobody stops and thinks how hard this all is. It's getting away from just having one that's the hard thing.
But I think there's... I teach up on the Navajo Indian Reservation in the northeast corner of Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And language problems, from the little I've learned about, are a mess. Because they've kind of, in many parts of the reservation, people speak Navajo exclusively. And then they've in the schools they've gone, at first they were, you would go to school in Navajo up until about third grade or something. Mm-hmm. And then they would switch to English. But there also wasn't a large body of literature written in Navajo. It was mostly a spoken language. Only more recently, linguists put things together in Navajo and so forth. Then they decided, no, we'll start these kids out in English from kindergarten on, even though they're still speaking Navajo at home. The result has been that the young people don't learn to read and write in either English or Navajo, and even their best students at high school are considerably behind, and they almost have to go to some kind of a community college or something to get up to speed, and the adults don't speak English or Navajo very well. They kind of,
How much local control is there over the Navajo school system?
It's
It's they're BIA schools. And so the politics is, I'm not really sure.
It considers itself a nation. I know the part of the Navajo Nation up near Farmington and that stuff. Right. I mean, they decide what they're going to do in their schools. And they are a nation.
Yeah, I was wondering whether BIA has control of that or the local folks.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, because it's, you know, the money are all mixed up and the BIA gets its money from... Navajos as a nation are very poor, so they're dependent on, you know, they're the poorest of the... I don't know if they're the poorest Native American.
Probably per capita, because they are large numbers.
Yeah, I know that on the Navajo reservation, the annual income per family is about $12,000, and the average size of the family is 8 to 10 people.
Yeah.
So that's substantially, you know, less than the average in the United States. So we have this 200,000 people basically living in poverty.
Yeah. I know the estimates of people who speak Navajo as primary language are still around 100,000, which is a very large number. It's the largest native language in North America. Yeah,
yeah. Well, that's probably... There are pockets there where they only speak. That's only... We have Lutheran churches there where everything's in Navajo. Mm-hmm. 2 hours in Navajo.
It's fun listening to it on the radio. Yeah, I used to always turn on the station, listen to the Navajo station.
Yeah. But how that's worked, I don't know, because it's true, communities, I mean, they still have a strong sense of community decision making and they work for consensus, but whether that impacts what the schools do, I'm not sure.
Well, in parts of Canada, and it's uneven, there's considerably more local control where it's primarily native area. Just north of us here in the same branch of Salish that the local natives were further north up, on up maybe 500 miles, most of the school districts are, they have a lot of Native input. British Columbia has changed their teacher qualification law so that there's a special category of teaching license for a Native teacher. And they have to be essentially recommended for this by the tribe. And they then work in the public schools. So they are essentially responsible. They are allowed by the public schools to bring Native education into it, and they are responsible for the content. So it's not the same kind of situation where you have the federal government providing the schools. And Canada has a Bureau of Indian Affairs with the same name, and essentially they give the education money to the tribal governments. They don't run schools anymore. At least in that part of British Columbia. I don't know how it works back east. It tends to be different in different parts of the country.
Yeah. We're on about an hour and a half or so.
Sure.
I guess we should
invite
people to stay if they have more.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting topic because culture and language and how we think about things.